fully get this music, you have to picture little hard rubber balls being shot out of tubes to precisely hit different strings, sometimes bouncing from string to string, and other tubes shooting the same balls at drums, snares, chimes, more than 100 of them flying through the air onto the wild array of instruments, some of the instruments robotically shifting their positions to catch the balls, all of it programmed by Animusic. It's music whose instruments are untouched by human hands. All the rest of the music coming up in today's show is handmade. But meanwhile, let's let the computer do it. It's animusic.com on Stay Human. Animusic.com. I'm Michael Goldberg. Human. Coming up on today's show, stories from people, folks I should call them, whose passions are in what they make with their hands. A bucket, a banjo, fishing lures and rugs. It's a crafty hour. I hope you can stay tuned. 50 years ago, young folks in eastern Kentucky brought together some elders and said, "Show us how you make that chair or tool or carving or what all, and tell us the stories that go with it. Sing us the old songs." They started up an enterprise called Apple Shop, spelled like the Appalachian region, and started holding lectures and classes and crafts and local culture, and helped bring in some money for local artisans too. By now, Apple Shop has grown to have its own community radio station and media training center, a theater, and all kinds of gatherings and coalitions for local folks to find ways to take care of themselves together. But it started in what's sometimes called the folk arts, meaning the knowledge shared by ordinary, uncredentialed people, knowledge based on what was handed down to them, knowledge that they can pass on to others, stories and music, and also how to make things. Even in a time of CGI wonders at the screen and 3D printers, the traditional ways of making and doing never go away. They're revivified by every generation because we need them. Up in Ely, listening to Northern Community Radio at 103.9 FM, you can take classes at Ely Folk School in rose mauling or chip carving, jewelry making or furniture building if you want to make it yourself. And in Grand Marais, you can learn to make your own skis out of birchwood or canoes, baskets and blacksmithing, weaving and wood carving, you name it, and North Home Folk School probably knows someone who knows how to make it. And there are places thriving all across rural America for people to get together to make things. Which means there must be how many artisans not getting together because their hands are busy in their workshop. I got a happy report this week from my old friend Joan Foster. She's well known in the Grand Rapids community as the proprietor of an important gathering place, her coffee shop in the middle of town. I'm sure I'm not the only one who misses her since she sold it and moved away last summer, but the change has allowed her to get back to working with her hands.
I think it was probably in about 1985 that I took a community ed class in Grand Rapids with Sam Shepard and fell in love with weaving. It was so fascinating to me. And I never had a loom of my own, but in 1991, I was in a car accident and was hurt so bad that I was not able to go back to work right away. And so I took my car insurance money and I bought a loom with it, a beautiful floor loom, and decided that, you know, when I need a car again, I'll figure out how to get a car. And a loom is always just going to be something I want. And so I bought a loom. And it was the smartest thing I ever did. Because in that car accident, I lost my daughter. She died. And having a loom gave me something to occupy myself and something to think about, and a way to be creative, and something to think about besides myself and my pain. And so every day I would get up and I would weave. And I did that for a year and a half, and then I had to go back to work. And in the meantime, I had learned a lot about weaving. I bought a curriculum and started out with very simple things. And every chapter, they would teach you how to do something new. And it was so good for me. It gave me a creative thing to do. And it was very healing. And so I go back to work. And I don't have time to weave anymore. And so for 21 years, I never had a warp on my loom until the beginning of last summer. I sold my business of 22 years, and I am now living on Madeline Island. And on Madeline Island, they have a craft hall that was started in 1955 with a generous donation by local summer residents, and originally designed to help the people who lived year-round on the island get through the winter because their income was dependent on tourists. And in the winter, it was hard for them to find a way to make a living. So the craft hall started out with weavers and wood carvers and woodworkers and jewelry makers. And it has grown from there for 63 years. And it is a nonprofit that is supported by the St. John's United Church of Christ, and it is just a fabulous place for the community. It's a real gathering spot and nurtures relationships and community events and provides income for the people that are there. And it has been great for me, as I'm sure it has been great for hundreds of people in the last 63 years. But I'm weaving again, and it's delightful. And it's really fun to weave in a studio where there are 10 different looms set up. So it's not like when you're at home with one loom and you have to use the same pattern and yarns that you have on your warp. until they're gone. You can do one project one day and move on to a different loom with a different warp, different color yarn the next day, and it's really fun. And I've met some beautiful, beautiful women, and I'm loving it.
Thanks to Joan Foster, now based on the Magic Island in Lake Superior. Here's a song called Tapestry from Liv Dawson on Stay Human.
Have you seen the seven oceans? Or the snow cap of a mountaintop? Or the northern lights set in motion? Oh, heartbeat slow to a stop. Have you read a book by candlelight? Or heard a leader's call to arms? Have you ever felt my love burn so bright? Like a fireball in your
tune to Northern Community Radio, connecting you to Northern Minnesota. Coming up, we have a report from Milt Lee talking with one of his favorite craftspeople. Milt produced a series of programs here at Northern Community Radio called Call of the Wild, exploring the creative economy of Northern Minnesota by visiting with many people who have figured out how to do what they love, including Danny Root.
No, I haven't fished for 40 years. I fished in high school, and a little bit after high school, my friends finally said, we don't want to fish with you anymore, because when they got me on the boat, when the lunch is gone, bring me to shore. And hunting, I never was much of a hunter. Dad would say, you know, he'd sneak up on me in the woods, and I'd be sleeping and listen to the radio and eating a Hershey's candy bar. And He'd say, you know, your heart's not in this. I said, what? I told you this years ago. You know, you can't make me you can't make me tougher. I like to sit here and listen to the radio and eat a candy bar.
Get ready for a wild ride. A guy who doesn't like to fish, but carves and creates beautiful and functional fishing lures and decoys. He builds it into a business and then calls it Larry the Bear, after a large carved bear that sits in his front yard. This week I'm laughing with Danny Root from Grand Rapids. Can't really say I'm talking to him.
I grew up on a farm about 7 miles out.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, went to high school in Grand Rapids, and then my wife's, she's a greenie from Coleraine, you know, that's... My friends tease me for that, but what are you going to do, you know? You're from not from around here. You'll know that Coleraine people aren't really normal. Sometimes you got to go out of town to get a girlfriend.
One thing that stands out about Danny Root is that he has a quirky worldview and even quirkier sense of humor. He and his wife, Nancy, early on built a construction business, and then later...
I think it was for 11 years we had a hosting company, web hosting.
Oh, did you?
That was pretty good. That was a lot easier than construction. But that's what got me into this. I just sit all day on that computer, and 10 o'clock at night, you're there talking to people. And so that's why I got started in this, and then I sold that computer business, and we don't need a lot of money.
Like many Northwoods creators, Danny stumbled into this new craft after buying a lathe at an auction. He began shaping chunks of pine, basswood, or spruce into lures and fishing decoys, and then painting them into something out of Fantasia.
That's a decoy. That's not a lure. The lure has hooks.
Yeah.
Decoy doesn't.
Would people use this?
Not that one. It's a real lure, but it's just too big. People think you're crazy if you pull that out of the boat. Yeah, your friends, if you pull that out of your tackle box, they'd bring you back to shore. They'd say, yeah, guys, these are nuts or been drinking too much.
Danny's lures and decoys are all functional. He tests each one in a water tank in his garage to make sure they can swim.
Now, when you lift them, they go nose up like they're going to the surface. And then when you let go, they go nose down and make a loop.
Walking into Danny's studio is like walking into an alternative universe. An underwater universe filled with fish.
He's great. You know, kind of come down here in your basement here, and it's like as if you were underwater and all these fish were swimming around you. They're all hanging from the ceiling and they're everywhere. And but the most colorful, kind of like as if you were underwater at Disney World.
It is kind of weird, yeah.
You're listening to The Call of the Wild. This week, I'm talking to Danny Root over in Grand Rapids. He is a non-fishing, fishing-making fish. I don't know what he is. Danny's hobby has grown into an art form, functional folk art that is sometimes hung in galleries and sometimes dropped into the bottom of a lake.
That one is weird. A guy came to me and he said, do you make any big decoys? And I showed him like a 12-inch one. He said, no, I mean big ones. He said, over 2 foot. And he said he used them, an old-timer. So I made three of them. And he said that he puts them in the water and doesn't even move them. And he looked on there, and there'll be another big northern laying right next to it. So he just moves it to the side and spears it. The decoys sell a lot, but I don't know if most people use them. I make quite a few that people say they're going to use them. Then I ask them later, I said, did you take a picture of any fish you speared of them? They say, I haven't put it in the water yet. I don't want to lose it. So it's kind of catch 22, you know. They're made to use. But then I made another big one that was 7 foot, weighed 107 pounds with a 8-point white tail rack on him. And he's hanging down at the Sportsman's Barber Shop. A friend of mine hung him because I had no room in the basement. I have fun making them. You know, I make quite a few of them. McCrossy sells quite a few. And then these redheads, I make these for the real spears. They think redheads work better because they grew up with a redhead decoy. And the only reason that they were redhead back then is because the old-timers made them, and the only paints they had were red and white on the barn. That's the color of paints they had. Now, I don't know that for sure. That's what an old-timer told me, and, you know, they'd never lie to you. So.
They're so beautiful. They're just intensely beautiful. I can't even...
Thanks. These are like one of a kind. This one and this one, I call them misfits. She won't let me sell the misfits for some reason. Here's a little baby beaver. Well, this is a lure now. You see a little lure? See the little feet on him?
Yeah, I see.
Little buck teeth? Don't he look just like a little baby beaver?
Yeah.
Now, if you were fishing with your friends and threw that out in the boat, they would bring you back to shore. They'd think you're crazy.
Danny even names each one of his creations. I love it.
This one's named Carmen. This is a Jackie. That's a big bluegill there. That one's named Lulabelle. I don't know. I think it's 20 inches, 22 inches.
Jeez.
It's pretty big. I don't think anybody put that in the water. People think they're crazy.
Danny does all of this for the love of it and the fun of it. I think he's definitely found his sweet spot. He sells some, hangs some in galleries, and donates many of them for local fundraisers. I know one thing. Someday one of these beauties is going to hang up in my studio, and I don't even fish.
I back my boat up to the water, then I set this bitch in. Looked around and told my friends, peeped the swagger with the jig. Cast it out and reel it in as bad as soon as it hits. I be hooking them lips, hooking them lips.
I'm Milt Lee with The Call of the Wild.
I back my boat up to the water, then I set this bitch in. Looked around and told my friends, peeped the swagger with the jig. Cast it out and reel it in as bad as soon as it hits. I be hooking them lips, hooking them lips. Okay, I'm headed to the water. Suited up, I got a plan. King Kong with the reel. Who's a Kevin Van Dam? I don't know, but I got so many fish up in my tank. If I don't slow it down and take a break, my boat might sink. And I can't have that happen. I am not about to slack. Sitting clean as a bitch with that Mercury Optimax. That Lawrence fish grinding like my navigation system. Where they at? This here gon' pick them up and I'ma go and get them. Jig hit the water splash. It's time to catch some bass. Fail to tug up on the line. Lean back, I got his ass.
Hooking them lips, and good luck to all the fisher folk out there this week with their tip-ups and ice houses. You're tuned to KAXE KBXE, broadcast service supported by the listener members who keep us on the air. Thanks also to the voters of Minnesota for the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, which helps support this and other local programs. Here's something different, a medley of 19th century minstrel banjo styles from Tim Twiss.
Thank you.
Thanks to Malou Brubaker of Goodland, Minnesota, for suggesting that piece of music. I've known Malou for years as a highly skilled artisan. Her jewelry has by now bedecked thousands of people, I guess, each of them feeling a little more beautiful because of what Malou made for them. But I only recently learned that she's also a banjo maniac.
I started with banjo when I was 14, and I've always played banjo. But I just recently changed the way I'm playing and what I'm doing with it exactly. So I got my left hand injured, which is the one that goes on the neck of the instrument and makes all the notes. And I couldn't reach as far anymore. And I was having a lot of trouble making chords as usual. Two note chords I could do, but more complicated ones with putting more fingers down, usually I couldn't reach them. So I complained to my brother, who is probably the one who's at fault for getting me into banjo to start with when he was a teenager. And he said, well, why don't you play a style that doesn't have chords? And I said, huh? And he said, well, like, for example, you could play round peak style, which is a mountain community in North Carolina or something. And they play a lot of single notes in a row instead of a chord that you would strum. So you don't have to have all your fingers down at the same time. So I got a book and a CD and started learning round peak style, and I really liked it, and I did that for a couple years. And then I kind of discovered that there were books on another style, which is interesting, which was old-time minstrel style or 19th century banjo style. And that was closer to the origins of the banjo in America, because minstrel style came right after and built on what the blacks, enslaved blacks, were actually playing on their banjos on plantations. And minstrel style pretended to be like a sort of expo of what was really happening on plantations, and it was kind of a lot of bad energy, but the music was really good. And it had people, you know, happy slaves dancing around and singing and saying how great it was and stuff, which is really offensive. But a lot of these minstrel players wrote their own songs based on the style, but there were also songs that you can tell came from the older style. Most of the minstrel banjos were really quite large, and the replicas that are being made are at least regular banjo size or larger. And then I decided I liked the deeper tones that they were using in the minstrel banjo, so I just thought I'd build one of those. I'd been messing with banjos since I was about 20 or something, rearranging, taking them apart, putting them together differently and stuff. So it wasn't real intimidating to me. And then my brother has built banjos, so that was kind of an entree into that whole world. I knew my brother had a jig in his blacksmith shop to make the hoop part, and so I just asked him to make the hoop for me. You in this style of instrument, you just take a strip of wood, a board, and bend it around and glue it. But it has to be all jigged up and clamped and stuff so it'll stay circular. And so he did that for me, so I didn't have to fuss with that. So basically I was going to be building all the hardware out of metal and then the neck, so, and a few extra pieces that make it all go together. So the first part was the neck, and I ordered some nice dried maple and some purple heart from a place out in Washington State, and it arrived in the mail, and I glued it together and left it for quite a while, which was good. And I cut it out to sort of like a profile shape of the neck and left it for quite a while, and that would be like a year or something. I just didn't get back to it. And then I just started carving with a bandsaw and rasps and Sureform files and sandpaper and stuff, and got the shape neck I wanted, and then glued a fingerboard on it and purple heart. And you have to, there's a lot of technical decisions to make there, so, you know, you kind of go slowly through it and try not to make too many mistakes. And Then I did decorative carving on the back, which is doesn't even fit this style of banjo, but I don't care. I'm not making a replica, so I just made what I wanted. And then I decided it would be fun to, instead of buying all the hardware, which a lot of makers do, to make all of it. So I made the bracket shoes, which are the metal parts that attach to the round rim and hold the brackets that pull the whole thing together. And I made those to match the carving. I made like an oak leaf motif on those. And then I made the brackets, which just because I wanted to make bracket nuts, and I wanted to do it all myself anyway. But there was a disconnect between the thread pitch that they use for brackets that you can buy and the pitch that I had available to me in the hardware stores of how to make the part that receives that. And so I wanted to make the nut that receives it, so I just made both parts so everything would match. So the nuts that receive it look like acorns because it's fun. This song is called Get Up in the Morning.
Playing the first banjo she made. This winter, she's making another one, this time made out of a gourd and closer to the Afro-Caribbean roots of the instrument. I can't even imagine being able to do something like that, and it delights me that she can. And she's hardly the only banjo maker in the woods.
I made this banjo out of a cookie tin. One out of a ham can, too, a Hormel ham can. But anyway, so I made this banjo, you know, the neck and the bridge and all that stuff. And then I started whittling pegs. This is so funny. So I whittled all these pegs, you know, for the banjo, and I got them all just the way I wanted them, and I got them in there. And one day we were in the hobby shop over in Bemidji, and I'm walking down the aisle, and I look down, and there's two boxes full of pegs, 50 cents a piece. And I spent days, I literally days, whittling out these pegs. And my kids got to laughing at me. They called me Pegs or Us.
But doesn't that banjo play better because you made the pegs?
I don't think so.
That's Don Newsom, who can make just about anything, I guess.
I was working at Boeing as a tool maker back in 99, 2000, and then after 9/11, well, they laid us all off. Well, so I came home to sue me, and man, I was making I was actually making some pretty good money on unemployment because it was aircraft related, and the government was paying us. You know, they laid us off, and they were paying us really good. So I thought, well, I'll just build my own shops, so which I did. And I thought when I did that I would I'd do a lot of work for, you know, farmers and ranchers and loggers. Well, that didn't pan out. I mean, I do a little work sometimes for Chef Logging. But other than that, you know, the only farm equipment I work on is for my wife. So, man, I had to find some way to,
you know, make a living. So anyway, I was out east, and John Hayes, an attorney here in town, introduced me to a friend of his who owns a Colonial-type hardware store out in Indiana. And he and I got to talk, and he says, Don, can you make me a bucket? I said, man, I don't know, Dan. I've never made a bucket before, but hell, I'll give it a try. So when John and I got back, we were headed out to Fort Fred, Maryland, and then I went on to Williamsburg. And anyway, so I got home, and I started working on this bucket. So I made this Dan a bucket, and I sent it to him. And, well, you know, can you change this or can you fix that? And I said, well, sure. So I made him another bucket, and he got it, you know, and he did the same thing. You know, well, I don't really, So he says, can you fix this or change that? So I said, sure. So I made him another one. Well, after making three or four prototypes, actually, I made like six or eight, but he finally got a bucket that he liked. He said, well, make me a dozen of those. So I did. And then it wasn't just a few weeks later, he called and make me another dozen of those. And pretty soon, I was making buckets, you know, and a lot of them. Like I said, he's a Colonial-type hardware store. So he sells to all kinds of historical sites and museums and movie production companies and things like that. Well, then he says, can you make me a canteen? Well, no, Dan, I never made a canteen before. But here's the deal. After 25 years of working for Boeing as a tool maker, and I don't know if you know what a tool maker does, but, you know, they bring you a part. And they say, we need to do this operation on this part. Can you make me something that'll hold this part on this certain machine? Well, yeah. So I take the part, and then I build a fixture, you know, and then they take it and put it on the machine and hold that part so they can do this certain operation to it. So I worked on all the space shuttles, and I worked on the B-1 bombers, and I worked on the MX missiles, and I don't know, all kinds of, you know, secret projects, but I never knew what they were. You know, I worked on the Bell Boeing Osprey, the one that crashes all the time. Not that I had anything to do with it. I never made a part for any of that stuff. I just made parts for the parts, if that makes any sense. But anyway, by doing that, it gave me the ability to look at things and figure out how I could make them in my machine shop. So that's why I figured, you know, he says, make me a bucket or make me a canteen or make me a rum keg or, you know, whatever. Then I always figured, well, hell, I can do that. So that's how I got into the bucket making business. It was just a way to make some money so I could live. And it worked out pretty good. And then I told you I went out to Colonial Williamsburg and I met with the Smithsonian people because they do all the curating for Colonial Williamsburg. And they juried all my product and then put me on a federal list. And so I've been doing work for, you know, museums and historical sites directly, not through Dan, but, you know, through the federal government. So, and that's how I got the job up at Grand Portage National Monument. You know, I made them a lot of buckets and wash tubs, and I built this fur press for them. It stands upright. It's about 7 feet tall. The screw, you stack a bunch of beaver pelts inside the press, and then you turn that screw, and it presses all the hair out of the beaver pelts so they can wrap them in canvas. Now, we're talking about 17th and 18th century work here. So that they can package them up really tight and the small as they can get them so they can get them in canoes. Most of those bales weigh about 90 pounds. And that's how they would get the product from Grand Portage, Minnesota, back to the East Coast, is they'd paddle them in these big canoes. And then they'd load them on ships and take them to Europe. But anyway, yeah, a lot of the buckets that I've made and the canteens and the rum kegs are all in various movies and things like I made a dozen buckets for Pirates of the Caribbean. And then I don't know, The Revenant, I've got rum kegs and canteens in that movie. I'd made some buckets that are in Hell on Wheels. And then I made a bunch of gunpowder kegs for the TV series Sleepy Hollow. Actually, I made, what did I make? I made about six of those, but they blew them up in the second episode, so you won't see them unless you watch that second episode where they blew them up.
Thanks to Don Newsom for being part of our program today. I'm Michael Goldberg with the handmade edition of Stay Human. Well, the radio show, of course, is not handmade. It's just a series of breaths and vibrations converted to electric impulses, stored as digital files, loaded up onto the computer that's managing this broadcast right now, turning it all back into sound waves, vibrations that I hope are good ones. I'm no kind of a craftsperson or artisan. I can do this and I can make toast, but when it comes to making things by hand, I'm enthralled to the many who can. Be sure to visit the local galleries and craft fairs this season. Get something that's one of a kind for somebody that's also one of a kind. I don't know, maybe if as a child I'd been around people who made things by hand, or even people who fixed stuff when it broke, you know, with that early brain development, maybe I wouldn't be so clumsy and clueless at it now. But as I grew up and started telling myself a story about who I am, I've always been more into breaths and vibrations, have always had a sure hand on the intangible. And then there was shop class, and by that time it was way too late.
Mr. Simonelli has a dead thumb, got it caught in a machine, now it's all numb. Keep your hands to yourself and your goggles on. Stay behind the yellow line when you're waiting to use the saw. Sarah made a salt shaker. When it hits the dinner table, it'll be a breath taker. She puffs it up till it shines. Oh, Sarah's salt shaker looks so much better than mine. In the woodshop. Shoot my pencil as I work out the angles. While the cool kids go smoke pot, I guide the blade through the beautiful lines I've drawn. Sand the edges of my spice rack, but halfway through I have a heart attack. I glued it together all wrong, so I stole the one that Sarah made and brought it home to my mom. From the woodshop. About time. Simonelli made the kids scream, put a nail through his thumb and says, I don't feel a thing. Well, I guess it's a bit like that. You're gonna be better off if you make it with your own two hands. In the woodshop. In the woodshop. In the woodshop. Oh, in the woodshop, you can hear the hammers drop.
Tim Fagan in the woodshop. We're fortunate here in northern Minnesota, I think, that our woods are so full of creative people, clever with their hands and undaunted by how much there still is to learn to do. Some of them are amateurs, the word means doing it for love, and many of those, as well as the professionals, highly skilled. The word craftsperson had a different meaning a few generations ago, for so much of our stuff was mass-produced and speeded up. My grandfather was a house painter, and he was always the craftsman for his boss's crews, assigned the detail work, ornate borders, and multicolored completion of elaborate plaster moldings and cornices. I thought of him and his generation recently when I was admiring the ceiling at Hibbing High School Auditorium. This is really one-of-a-kind theater, 1,800 seats, built as part of the high school but designed for professional touring companies with a rare pipe organ, only three of them ever made, 200 pipes concealed in the walls, chandeliers made of crystal from a factory destroyed in World War II, all of it built and assembled by craftsmen 100 years ago, most of them first-generation immigrants on the Iron Range. I was at the auditorium for the live broadcast of the Great Northern Radio Show, written and hosted by Hibbing native Aaron Brown. The community has just recently completed a meticulous and gorgeous restoration of the hall, right down to every detail. It really is something to see, especially if you can see it through the eyes of Aaron Brown. Here's what he said about it from the stage that night.
For those of you listening on the radio or on your personal devices, I can assure you that words do this scene no justice. Some high school auditoriums are nicer than others, no doubt. Technically speaking, mine was a gym and a cafeteria and a tornado shelter, now that I think of it. But about 100 years ago, people here in Hibbing, some forward-thinking people, sent a message to the kids in their town and to all the kids that would come after. They sent a message that was, for you, only the best will do. Those words live on today, even though the people who thought of the idea are long dead. And that's probably for the best. The people who have to dust these $250,000 Czechoslovakian chandeliers, you know, I'm sure they'd have some choice words for those founders for bringing these things into the building. But, you know, it's a lot easier to mop the floors, the tile floors of a steel-sided pole building than to maintain great architecture. And, you know, that's really the reason modern architecture looks the way it does. You know, architecture is one of those jobs that most kids imagine doing at some point in their lives. It's the logical extension of building Lego cities or a sandcastle that reaches higher than you stand. It's a career that at first blush seems fitted for imagination, originality, maybe even a touch of whimsy. But what kids find out when they get older is that architecture is mostly just lots and lots of math so the roof doesn't fall down. Architects are all too happy to point this out. Dreams of gables and gambrels quickly give way to the realities of load-bearing walls and limited budgets. Cost per square foot. Oh, that's the word. Cost per square foot, they cry. The more marble and hardwood you add, the higher the cost per square foot. Murals and carved molding. Cost per square foot. What if we use styrofoam instead? Pipe organs come precious, so how about a cassette player and a pair of tinny speakers strapped to the stage? Now, this is the same argument that people use for buying a 24-pack of Busch Light instead of a growler of craft brew. Think of the unit price. Think of how much more you would have if you valued it less. It's a logic that only fails when you speak it aloud. For the children of Hibbing, only the best for you. That's the promise you are given, delivered in a building that lasts. So we sit here in the Hibbing High School Auditorium, a room that quietly inspired Bob Dylan and thousands of other sons and daughters of the Iron Range. You know, enjoy the upholstery. They could have put in plastic. Sure they could have. They went for comfort and class, though. Look at the meticulous detail of the ceiling, the art, the trim. You know, they could have just put in a drop ceiling. That would have been cheaper for sure. In fact, you could throw this whole place out brick by brick, replacing every facet with something cheaper and more temporary. But this town would fight you every step of the way. You can't throw this place out because it's who we are. We have to pay to build. We have to fight for beauty. And when money is tight, we can do it ourselves. we can build ourselves. Only the best for you. Why would we want less for the next generation?
Aaron Brown with the Great Northern Radio Show. Watch for announcements of the next live production coming to a town near you. The show always features local musicians, including that night, Sam Miltich with guest vocalist Connie Evenson and this live performance.
I could show the world how to smile. I could be glad all of the while. I could change the gray skies to blue if I had you. I could leave my old ways behind, leave all my pals. I'd never mind. I could start my whole life anew if I had you. I could climb the snow-capped mountains. I would sail the mighty ocean wide. I could cross the burning desert if I had you by my side. I could be a queen, dear, uncrowned, humble or poor, rich or renowned. There is nothing I couldn't do if I had you.
Sam Miltich and Connie Evenson on vocals. You're listening to Stay Human on your sometimes handmade radio service, KAXE KBXE. Thanks to Aaron Brown, Don Newsom, Malou Brubaker, Milt Lee, Danny Root, and Joan Foster for being part of today's show. And thanks to all the craftspeople out there, some of whose work I own or have admired through the years. Please keep it up, friends. I'd like to think you might even be at work in your studio right now, half listening to this. Here's some music picked out just for you from Bella Fleck.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.